Trigger warning. This episode mentions suicide and suicidal ideation. Listener discretion is advised.
Which Muslim travels
post 9/11 without their
passport? I'm a Muslim and That's Okay presents Gift of the Gab, because everybody's got something to say. Hi everyone, may peace be on you all, and welcome to another episode of I'm a Muslim and That's Okay. And those who are on video can see my lovely co-host, who has decided that she's going to go completely bonkers on me today. It's my parakeet, my little mariposa, and she's all over me, and I'm not sure what to do. I would put her back, but then she'd start chirping in her cage. We're not going to do that. I'm hoping that she does not interfere too much, but, you know, entertainment for all those who can see us. And I'm with my lovely guest, Amelia Noor Oshiro. How are you doing, Amelia?
Assalamu alaikum. Alhamdulillah. Everything's going well. Hi, mariposa. Hola, ¿cómo estás?
And I have Amelia with me as my second Gift of the Gab guest. And as I explained to all y'all last episode, that this season has been an entirety of really some really heavy, deep topics. And continuing in that vein, I have Amelia with me to have a very important discussion. So before we get into that, Amelia, please tell my audience a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Absolutely. I identify as Muslim, and I conduct research on the U.S. Muslim community in terms of understanding what factors are related to good mental health and also to outcomes like suicide. So trigger warning, you know, it is September, Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, and identify as an attempt survivor. So I've also had several hospitalizations, two involuntary and one voluntary hospitalization. And so what I kind of say is that I bring lived experience as who, you know, has mental illness and has gone through the system. And then also there's like an activism and scholarship side that I bring to science. And so I'm trying to merge both of those and be an advocate and bring more political attention to suicide prevention.
That is so amazing. And right now you're pursuing your PhD in the studies, if I'm not mistaken. I think if I had to begin somewhere, Amelia, it's just that... It is indeed, as you said, it is your lived experience. But if I had to like start anywhere, and I've asked this question before, is that there's already research out there for suicide and suicide attempts and things that make people more prone, less prone to any of this. Yours is focused on being Muslim-centric. Why is that important?
Oh, yeah. I love that question. First of all, let me say that Muslims are scientifically considered a hard-to-reach population. What that means is that, you know, there's a lot of national health databases that collect all kinds of health outcomes for different populations. Muslims are not represented on those. So, like, the Muslim identity where it's like, you know, you check your race, your age, whatever. You know, faith identity is not included in that. And so it's important to conduct research on Muslims, not just because, you know, we're not represented on those databases and we need to know how our health as a population, as a collective is doing. And so we can kind of make interventions and hopefully promote better health for us as an entire collective. But of course, it's also very important because the Muslim demographic in the United States is scientifically a very interesting population to study. And I'll tell you why. Number one, this country is headed to being of majority non-white population by around 2050. We're going to have also, you know, dual language speaking citizens, right? Like people who speak Spanish and English. So the immigrant kind of fabric of the United States is going to be a lot more prominent. And Muslims are a very ideal population to study scientifically because we are majority of migrant origin. So around 75 to 80% of us, according to Pew Research Center, is composed of first, second, and third generation immigrants. Majority first and second being first meaning, you know, you were born somewhere else and then you came to the United States. And then second generation meaning you were born in the United States, one of your parents or more were born somewhere else. And that's according to the U.S. Census definitions. Mm-hmm. So when we think about what informs good mental health and preventing suicide, that's a very critical piece of information, because being of migrant origin has been shown in some studies to have an effect on mental health. Mm. And especially for second generation, people who are born in the United States, again, have at least one foreign-born parent, their risk is especially of interest because they tend to be at higher risk than their parents for all sorts of negative health outcomes, not just mental health, but in suicide, particularly second generation is very critical because, you know, we have a lot of different factors, which I can talk about. And then lastly, I would say also generally in the world population, Muslims are obviously like there's billions of us, right? And on top of that, you know, we're going to be facing climate change. And there's going to be a shift in where people are located. And the impact of that is a lot of instability. There could be economic instability, political instability, and that can ultimately lead to poor health outcomes. And so it's important to kind of look outside and see like, wow, the, you know, around a quarter to a third, the estimates vary, of the world's youth is going to be Muslim by 2030. So this is a very important matter because in the United States, we know that suicide is a leading cause of death, a top three leading cause of death in young adults. So Muslims could really be a very critical population to study in the research to get insights for now and to prevent future bad health outcomes.
That's a lot of information, Amelia, but we're going to like cut it down piece by piece. I think if I had to start somewhere, like really making it bite sized, I thought it was very interesting when you said that second generation is most at risk. Okay, even before I get to that, let's go all the way back. You had said that Muslim demographics are hard to really pinpoint in terms of research. One of them is because, you know, surveys don't have like a religious identifier in the in them. They should have race, gender, all of those things, but never a religious identifier. That's one factor. Are there any other factors that would make Muslims particularly hard to pinpoint when it comes to such like a research?
Shayla, I love that you asked that question because one of the things that's a little bit of a pet peeve of mine as a scientist is that when we conduct research on Muslim mental health, you know, researchers who identify as Muslim or otherwise, I think there's an assumption that people who end up responding to those calls for research, whether they're surveys or what have you, the assumption is that people do identify as Muslim or also it's conflated between identifying as Muslim and practicing or observing as Muslim. And I think one thing that's a very critical point to underscore is that not all Muslims identify as Muslim. Maybe they were born Muslim and don't identify anymore. Maybe they were raised Muslim and don't identify anymore. Maybe they had converted but don't identify anymore. Those are critical populations and they might even, who knows if they have a higher risk than generally Muslims who do identify as Muslim, right? And so those factors are actually under this broader category of social factors of sociology and how people relate to their identity and relate to the collective ummah, if you will, of Muslim identity and belonging. So I think it's very critical because you might find different insights based on how strongly people value the Muslim identity for
I think very important because, again, like part of the reason I do my podcast is just that we're not one monolith. We exist in so many different ways. And then gathering information from that is, dang, I mean, if y'all doing it, I give you mad props because it's hard under any circumstance. But again, second question, which sort of came to me first, is that You'd said, you know, again, 2050, I've done research on this as well. I've done my paper, master's papers, like most people will be of dual races by 2050 and speaking more than one language within the United States. And that's the thing. I was sort of expecting in my mind, like first generation immigrants would be at higher risk of suicide because, you know, it's such a like a new experience in a new country, leaving behind everything you knew. But you said that it's a greater risk in second generation. Could you clarify that? Because I think a lot of people really don't perceive it as that.
Absolutely, yes. And I will say, I don't know if it's dual race, but definitely bilingual.
Right, right.
And in terms of like second generation, so I think the thing that's really important about that, and you bring up the very important point of what we call the healthy immigrant paradox. Mm-hmm. Public health. So just like you said, why is it that people who come here to this country, like some of them don't even speak the language, some of them do, but you know, the cultural shock is there, mm-hmm. the culture shock, the cultural norms. And then, you know, there's just a number of factors that you would think like people might become hopeless,
right?
Because they came to the country. But what's really important to note is, you know, a lot of times people who come to this country will have some kind of social support network. If they're coming in through certain, like, you know, verified migration processes, which generally tends to be the case in the Muslim community.
Right.
Right. We do have undocumented. We do have unauthorized people who don't have papers, you know, but at the same time, we, most of us don't experience that. And so for those of us who don't experience that and do generally tend to come here and have either family or friends or some kind of connection here, it's been shown in the Latinx community, for example, that there is that collectivist tradition is still there. Right. And that's very important because when we think about what are factors that promote good health, resiliency, positive attitudes and positive perceptions, a lot of it has to do with your social support. Mm. So when you think about, you know, what is the mentality of a first generation versus a second generation? Well, what's the norm? What's the social norm that they're coming with?
Right.
Usually, you know, back home in traditional culture in our, you know, home countries, it's predominantly a collectivist norm. Over here, it's more individualistic in America, in the United States, in the West, global North, if you will. So that poses a problem because the individualism can lead to a lot of isolation, and it could also lead to lack of social support, quality social support. And in the scientific research, the way we measure that is not just by how many quantitatively, how many people you have that might be able to help you out. Like you need to text somebody of, hey, can we grab something for dinner or can we talk really quick? I'm not feeling good. You know, that kind of thing. But it's also the quality of the social support. So do you feel like you can trust somebody? Mm. Are they reliable for you? Are they consistent? And is it a positive relationship? Is it a positive bonding experience and not a negative bonding experience? So those things are really critical because, you know, when you're coming to the United States, you know, it could be a very isolating experience. So I'm not speaking in terms of like, you know, broadly, because there is variation in what kind of experience you have. But in terms of what the data have pointed out, this is what makes it a paradox, is because you would think that with all those barriers, you might have poor mental health. But there's also a lot of resiliency, a lot of survivalism, right? The way I like to explain it is like people who are in the first generation, their main focus is not on belonging necessarily, right? Like belonging is important and it's very critical. But in terms of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, what's important first is shelter and food and, you know, clothes, you know, those things that are really important, you know, and making a good life for their, to prepare for their children or, you know, offer their children good access to education, et cetera. So that's usually what's on their mind. So it's a hustle. It's a hustle mentality.
Right.
Second generation, they're born here in the United, you know, American culture is familiar to them. What ends up becoming unfamiliar is the back home culture. and the norms. And the very critical part about this, Shayla, this is the most important part, is a language difference. Because there's some research that points to language differences leading to family conflict, right? Like if the person at home, the second generation kid, doesn't know how to speak Urdu, for example, or doesn't know how to speak Spanish, that can create some problems, because language itself is a representation of our mental constructs, of our social constructs.
Right.
And so there are certain words that exist in certain languages that don't exist in other languages.
Right.
And so that is an example of how even just how our worldview is shaped can be very different for the parents compared to the children.
Right.
And then obviously there's a family pressures that go into that for the second generation. You know, the second generation is generally different than the first in terms of their hierarchy of needs. Maybe they do have they don't have to worry about material hardship, like you know, finding food or shelter. Maybe those needs have been met by that point, even if they're not so stable. But for the most part, there isn't a survivalist need the same as the first generation. But the second generation is more concerned about things like belongingness, identity, and essentially being socially integrated.
Right.
And when you're not socially integrated, it can lead to isolation, which is a huge predictor of suicide.
That's so interesting. Again, it's one of the things that really doesn't come to mind immediately, but I'm glad you brought it up. It's a it's an interesting point to really note, especially like us of immigrant, all myself first generation, but again, I never thought of it that way for the for my kids. Like, yeah, that could be a huge issue. Like, how do they, because again, my kids, I could speak to them in Urdu for all it's worth. They ain't gonna pick it up because it's natural. Their friends don't speak in Urdu. It's like I'm the only one yelling at them in Urdu whenever, you know, you go into mom mode. But yeah, it's, you know, there is that, you know, inside the home, it's different, but outside the home, the world exists so differently for them as opposed to me. I grew up in Pakistan, you know, everything was different. Expectation, all these things were so different. So I can see how that, you know, creates so much pressure. So you are here focusing on the Muslim population when it comes to this research. How did this sort of come about, the thought of this research? Was it through your lived experience, or were there other factors that sort of came into play that this is a need that you needed to fill?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I will say one thing, but based on what you just said, too, is that it also matters for the first generation what age you came.
Right.
Because if you when you were earlier, like younger, then the identity does play a lot more of a role than if you come after like 25 years old or so, or 20, when your identity is more set and you're developmentally more mature. In terms of what got me to Muslim mental health, yes, a lot of it was lived experience, but I wasn't very open about my lived experience in the beginning. So I started grad school in 2015. I actually had to defer because I ended up getting married and getting pregnant right away. And so I ended up deferring. I thought I was going to do, you know, maternal mental health in humanitarian settings, had nothing to do with being Muslim, although I was hoping to serve in Muslim majority countries. And over the course of that year that I had deferred, my spouse was in a grad program doing his doctorate on critical race theory and special education.
Right.
And over that year, you know, it was the first year of our marriage, essentially. He was like a big mentor for me because I started learning about white supremacy and I started, you know, and, you know, the 2016 election was right around the corner. And so I felt like I had this crash course in how, you know, the United States fabric of social norms was going on. And, I started my grad program, and about the first semester in, after the first semester, I emailed the administrators. I was like, there's a lot of Islamophobia going on. I feel like a really strong need to change my major, my department, my thesis advisor, my thesis topic. Literally everything flipped upside down. And I was like, I need to do something about this because Muslim mental health, like, who cares about this? Who's caring? Where are the voices? Where are the stories? Right. And most of all, I felt like my particular story was very underrepresented because I was a young parent as well. And the Muslim mental health field, although it had already existed, like the Journal of Muslim Mental Health had at that point, I think, been around for maybe like over half a dozen years. Mm. So that had been around. But, you know, there wasn't any research on being visibly Muslim, like wearing a headscarf or like other markers that generally tend to speak, you know, Muslim identity in American society. So I was like, let me see if there's any connection between this visibility and having any symptoms of mental illness, like depression or stress or anxiety. And that's what it did turn out to have in terms of not necessarily visibility, but just Muslim, being Muslim and female, for example. So females were way more hypervigilant than males. And I thought there, the reason I included hypervigilance in that study was because at that time I was wearing hijab. So I had worn hijab for about 5 years until basically my body just, you know, developed this disability called POTS. And it's a longer story, but I ended up having to let go of hijab. And so during that time, I was like, this is New York. Like, this is super diverse and people are welcoming here. But then I saw MAGA hats all over at the same time. And so I was like, I'm not the only one suffering. I'm not the only one thinking like being hijabi might put me at risk for like a hate crime.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's what inspired that study. And by the time I ended up graduating and writing my master's thesis, I ended up presenting that study at the American Public Health Association conference. And I ended up applying to doctoral programs without necessarily thinking I was going to go down that route. But I felt such a strong inclination to do something about it. And then in my grad program, I ended up doing a fellowship for trauma and violence research, where I got exposed to a whole bunch of different communities, like Native American communities, LGBTQ communities, that had really high rates of suicide. And my advisor mentioned it. She was like, you should do something on suicide. And I felt like that, I just felt like it was a bad idea, because I was like, Muslims and suicide in the same sentence have always never been like a good, good thing. You know? It's not a good reflection of us. Like, it's airing our dirty laundry. Like, why would I go down that? But throughout the course of my grad program, I started just realizing, like, I felt like no one would take Muslim mental health seriously enough unless there was like a dramatic outcome like suicide. And that's a really sad thing to say, but that's just what I feel like it was going to take. Because I knew that I was suicidal. All right, let's just put that out there. I knew at that point I had really severely suicidal. I didn't actually think I was depressed for a really long time. I was like, I'm not depressed. I'm functional. I'm this, I'm that. I'm in grad school. But, you know, the more I started learning scientifically about the research behind suicide, that was really part of what motivated me too, because I needed answers. I need answers. Why am I so suicidal all the time? Why? And I know that, like, maybe some other people, like my friends and stuff, they're not saying it, but we share similar lived experiences of discrimination, of oppression, microaggressions. So if we're sharing those lived experiences, I can't be the only one who's suicidal here. So that's what ultimately got me into going to my first suicide prevention conference, because another advisor invited me to it. And that particular conference was actually focused only on Latinx population. That moment, though, that was a life-changing moment for me. In May, was it 2019, I believe? Yeah, I think I went to that conference in May 2019. And the Latinx researchers that were up there, they were talking about all the things that we're talking about. You know, the Muslim ban was so similar to, like, the deportation conversations they were having. And I was like, our population has so many parallel similarities as the Latinx non-Muslim population that I was like, okay, we really need to do something about this. And that's when the momentum started. And I was like, this is it. I'm doing this. And by November of 2019, I started my social media channel, Muslim Suicide Researcher.
And again, I can't stress enough how important this is. As somebody who has also experienced suicidal ideation, it's not something you're completely prepared for, especially within Muslim context, where there is serious taboo regarding the subject. It's like so unspoken of that anybody, you know, could be get to a dangerous point before realizing mm-hmm. that they need help. Mental health is poorly understood as well, things that could really push a person to do this. But it is definitely, definitely an important thing that does need to be highlighted, researched effectively, so that people who are struggling, like you and me, we can get the help we need. So mm-hmm. what are you doing currently, Amelia? That's the thing. That's where, you know, it all boils down to what's happening right now and how is your research progressing?
Yes. So what is happening right now? We do know that there was one study by Stanford and Dr. Rania Awad's lab and Dr. Hamada Hamid at Yale and their colleagues that suggested Muslims compared to other faith groups have a higher odd of attempting suicide in their lifetime compared to other faith groups. And I think that was a launching point for a lot of the initiatives that we're seeing today in mm-hmm. the Muslim community, the United States Muslim community. My research in particular is less so focused on faith-based factors, although that is a part of my research and it's a very, very important part of research. Let me tell you, prayer, spirituality, those are extremely important for your mental health. Mm-hmm. However, my research is a little bit more complementary from what has been done in the past in terms of social factors. Mm. So like I said earlier, that identity of being Muslim, that in and of itself is a huge factor related to whether or not someone has risk of XYZ disease or outcome or suicide. And I'll tell you why. It's because your social identity sometimes corresponds to your behaviors.
Right.
So, you know, people who are socioeconomically disadvantaged may be more likely to behave in criminal ways, right? Like, for example, theft.
Yeah.
For their survival,
right?
But if you're not socioeconomically disadvantaged, you might also be a thief and, you know, have, you know, more like, you know, I don't know.
Kleptomania is real.
Yeah. But it's just not coming from a survival perspective, right? And you is as a high status person. Mm. And generally people with high status want to be favored and retain their high status.
Right.
Right. So they're not going to be engaging in those types of behaviors unless they're like, you know, Donald Trump, who's just criminal and just, you know, does, hey, Donald Trump. But I'm saying also in terms of like risky behaviors, right? So people who are marginalized or stigmatized and just generally feel more invisibilized by society, they could also tend to have more risky behaviors.
Right.
And that can be a lot of Muslims, mm-hmm. right? We are stigmatized. I mean, I think there's been a lot of work going against stigmatizing us. And kind of allowing us to be included in the, you know, normal image of who an American is and what an American stands for. But the work that we're doing in terms of preventing suicide in the future, that's what you're saying, is the work of social norms change. Because when you change social norms, you can change behaviors. Mm-hmm. When you change behaviors, you change society. Mm-hmm. And it has a lot to do with who is in power and what type of norms the people in power want to purvey. Mm-hmm. So a common example is, you know, what was her name? Who is the one who was in Breakfast at Tiffany's?
Oh, geez. Audrey Hepburn?
Audrey Hepburn.
I don't even know why I know this, but still.
Yes. She popularized, you could say she popularized eating sushi because there was a picture of her eating sushi and she's a high class, high socioeconomic celebrity status person, right? And she's eating sushi. And what was sushi at the time? Like, you know, when she was alive. But the fact that someone like that brought that into popular culture made it a social norm over time. Mm-hmm. And these are things that are very important because suicide in this country has become normalized, if I might say that, right? Because at this point, Shayla, I literally, this is subhanAllah, this is what happens. I don't know if it's just like me, but I was driving around Baltimore and just on the like the train stop, there was this like advertisement saying 988 crisis hotline if you need help. And then I see it just like randomly everywhere now. I just see it everywhere. And as someone who's a social behavioral scientist, you know, I feel like that is a reflection of our society, that this problem has become endemic, not an outbreak, not an epidemic. It's an endemic.
Right.
And that means that it's been going on for a while.
Right.
And we're treating it as if it's not going to go away anytime soon. That's right. What an endemic is.
Right.
And so in terms of where the future goes, I think Muslim mental health, suicide prevention has a lot of potential to change the world and change social norms.
I couldn't agree with you more, because the thing is, when the popular discourse is that we didn't have it in our time, why is it now? But the problem is that suicide has always existed since the beginning of time. Okay. Since the beginning of people, suicide has always existed. But the problem is that for so long, we've done very little about preventing it or even acknowledging that it is a problem. And then it gets to a point where it just spills over if you don't do anything about it.
Acknowledge it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first thing. You can't prevent something you don't acknowledge. Mm.
So, yeah, that's the thing. Now we have to come to terms with it, you know, not just as Muslim, but as society is large, that this is a problem and we need to do more to find out the whys and prevent the whys or fix the whys. And it's not one thing. It's not just like mental wellness. You're cured. You're not going to. There's so many factors that even step into mental wellness. It's not just like I have a family history of anxiety. You know, if you get rid of anxiety, stops all the problems. People, as you'd said, lower socioeconomic status. There's a lot of pressure, you know. People are doing multiple jobs, still can't make ends meet. That's a huge factor in mental wellness going down. You know, those are all those things. There's multiple factors, as you said, environmental factors. I, you know, stay up scared a lot of nights being like, what kind of earth are my kids going to inherit? Because we've done so many things that are wrong. You know, all of these things are huge factors that need to be fixed before we can say, suicide is no longer endemic. And I think the work you do is so crucial, especially for the Muslim community. So please let us into what you're doing right now. I know you have a survey out. So what does the survey focus on? I'll have a link to that survey in my show notes so that Muslims who really want to help you can help you. Please, like, we need, and it's anonymous, I believe. You don't have to like put in like names or any identifiers, but just the experience and what you experience in a sort of a suicidal ideation, or if you've attempted suicide, just that information is so helpful for you. So please give us a little more details about the survey that you have out.
Yes. So thank you so much. You know, the point of doing this survey is really to just get the word out there that we are doing something about this problem. Mm-hmm. And hopefully, inshallah, you know, the survey isn't the most ideal format because, you know, you're behind the screen. But I had to adapt a lot of my research aims for COVID because I had begun this research right when COVID hit. Mm. So I had to change a lot of what that research looked like. So it went from in-person stuff to just online. Mm. And then I ended up thinking, well, you're online, you're more anonymous. But some people, you know, I don't know, I had to think a lot about even just being online because there's trolls out there.
Yeah.
So I had to be careful about where I disseminate the study and only with people in I trust. I ended up partnering with Family Youth Institute, which I'm sure you're familiar with, FYI. Mm-hmm. Mashallah, they're doing great work, and they have supported me for this study. And so we've been trying to recruit. I also got support from MSA West. So if you're familiar with that organization, they're also helping me recruit. But I haven't had a lot of responses because we've gone through the email newsletters. The survey itself, you don't have to even answer all the questions. You can just skip all the questions that you don't feel like answering.
Right.
So, you know, in the beginning, you'll see some demographic questions, and then you'll see questions related to your identity as Muslim or other intersectional markers of your identity. And then you'll also see questions related to your psychological health. There's going to be questions about, you know, mood, Then there's also questions just about your overall like experiences. And so then there's open-ended questions where you can type and respond, like what has made you feel hopeless in life? And that's been a really good question for people to respond to, because that's a very critical point where we can find interventions. And so the point of this survey is to start an infrastructure, really, to start an overall infrastructure for people who are interested in developing evidence-based community-based programming, maybe. You know, these are the types of the insights that come from this research. I was hoping it would lead to getting going to Muslim leaders and saying, here's what I'm finding. Here's like, maybe we can optimize some of your programs to include addressing so-and-so topic. You know, there's in public health, one of the approaches we've used is in terms of like faith-based practice research. Going to the sermons and having sermons actually be public health infused. So in terms of like khutbahs, that would look like, you know, an imam talking about suicide prevention on the Friday of whatever, you know, like just, and these are really important conversations to have, because I think when the research is one thing, but people have to value you as a researcher. And I think that's the part I've had the most difficulty with, Sheila. I will say, I don't know if it's that I don't wear hijab, or like, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's not me. Maybe it's just the research itself. I don't know what it is, but I think that people don't necessarily understand the value of social and behavioral science. And that's really important, because, you know, COVID, one of the big things about COVID that people didn't realize initially is that your social networks have a lot to do with how much at risk you are of getting COVID.
Right.
Social network, that's a social and behavioral approach to preventing the spread of COVID. And social distancing, that's a term that came from our field. Physical distancing, that came from our field. Our field was critical in handling and managing the COVID epidemic. And it the same applies to any health outcome, especially suicide, especially because suicide can be contagious and lead to contagion. Or in other words, one person's suicide can make other people feel suicidal and attempt suicide and actually die by suicide. So, you know, I think if I were to say one thing, it's just that this research, I mean, I don't have a lot of responses to my survey right now. I only have 25 responses to my survey. I needed at least 200. In the past, in the research I told you about, the Muslim visibility, I had almost 400 people respond to me. I had no problem collecting that data, because it happened right around the Trump election. So there was a lot of momentum, and, you know, survey research wasn't as popularized back in, you know, 2016. But now it's 2023, you know, it's like almost a full decade later, and research has become really popularized, but people still in the Muslim community, like, what, who do we have? You tell me, Sheila, how many times have you seen a speaker at a conference, at ISNA, at ICNA, at MASS, who's a sociologist?
I'd be very hard pressed for that.
Yeah, it's, and they exist. I know them. I know Muslim sociologists. They've got PhD in sociology. And now even I'm not a rare unicorn, because I actually met someone who's studying at Harvard now, who's a first year in social behavioral sciences. And she's Muslim. She's, you know, she wears hijab and everything. Mashallah. So I was like, wow, great. Now there's going to be more of us. But at the same time, it hasn't been valued. Like, our knowledge, our approach, sometimes also can, I think, be very scandalous because we're talking about issues in the, you know, issues related to social identity, gender, race, you know, faith. Those things can be already so sensitive, let alone suicide. And so I feel like I wish I had the trust from Muslim leadership to be like, hey, this person knows their stuff. They've been highly qualified. They've been trained at UCLA. They've been trained at Columbia University. They've been trained at Johns Hopkins University. They literally have on paper like every credential you could ask for. And yet I feel like my voice hasn't had a place in the community, because I think it's just we aren't familiar with what.
There's so many different factors to it, Amelia. That the sociology aspect is one that we're like So what does that, what, it's not like a doctor and engineer, okay? Yeah, y'all ain't making money, okay? I'm sorry, I didn't mean it that way, but, you know, we are drawn to all of these, like, doctor, engineer, IT, like, it's the money makers, like, what does a sociologist do? I don't know. There's very little real knowledge about, you know, the importance of what a sociologist does. There really isn't. Second of all, there is, like, even in the broader context, people don't like talking about social issues. They don't. It makes them very uncomfortable. It's like digging up parts of themselves that they'd rather sweep under the rug. Suicide? Girl, that's one of those things that is like, that's like in the deepest recesses of that poor rug that we're sweeping a lot of things under. So it's definitely not just because of you per se. It's just like we as a community are sort of socially constructed to be like within bubbles. But I'm hoping that this can change that because your survey is so essential. It's going to be in my show notes. Every Muslim who's listening to this. Oh, before I forget, is this just open to Muslims within the US? Because, you know, I have listeners abroad as well. Would they be able to take the survey?
It is. The eligibility criteria is to be in the United States. And I can't say much more about the eligibility criteria because it might affect things. Yeah, it might affect a lot of, you know, stuff that makes this data valid.
Right.
Go to the link. It's just tinyurl.com/Muslim Community Study. Mm. And it'll take you directly to there. The incentive is a $25 Visa gift card lottery, which, you know, if I end up having, you know, 100 respondents, everyone's probably going to get the gift card.
Right.
So, right. You know, like, it's really like, it's not like there's a low chance of you getting it.
Right.
And it's not the lottery that I'm hoping people are incentivized by. You know, I really hope that people, especially people who've experienced suicide in terms of their lived experience, maybe they themselves have had struggles or ideation. Maybe they have a friend or a loved one who's had struggles. Maybe they know someone who passed away. Mm. Maybe they know of someone in the community who they may not have known personally, but someone in the community had died by suicide.
Right.
Those are people that we really need to hear from because I have big plans, Shayla, inshallah. I have big plans for understanding and helping our community. And I think that part of what has really kind of brought me down over the years is not knowing if there's enough trust for me to do the research that I'm doing, which is community-based participatory research. It's a very particular type of research, CBPR. Mm. It's an approach and it's a social justice framework.
Right.
But in order to do it, you need to have trust in the community, and the community needs to, like, essentially be very comfortable with you and feel safe around you. So I've worked really hard to try and build rapport with the community, especially through my social media channel. I was like, maybe this is a strategy I could use to try and show people the value of the research I'm doing, right? And so the social media channel is part of that strategy. And obviously going to the Muslim Mental Health Conference, I've presented there a number of times. Alhamdulillah, I've had a good amount of support from people who attend the conference. Mm. So, you know, I do feel like there are some people in critical gatekeeping positions. But I think on the ground from a grassroots like masjid or third space perspective, that's where I'm really missing a lot of connection. And I would really appreciate being connected to like the imams and the masajid leadership boards and, you know, the third spaces, the people who do the nonprofit works or just in general, like, you know, being Muslim, Islamic Relief, Helping Hands, whatever. These people, like, they're all really well connected in the community, and I'd love to kind of connect with them and see if they could send the survey out. And we're really looking for a lot of things in this research, right? One is we want to test generational differences. So we want to get a wide range of people who of age ranges. Mm-hmm. So, you know, from 18 years old up to however old you are, I'd love to see it. We want to see if there's any differences based on your identity. We want to see if there's any differences based on your language.
Right.
These are all really, really important factors because at the end of the day, we want to see what can be extrapolated to other communities who are hard to reach, like Latina, or I'm sorry, other communities who are marginalized or invisibilized. underrepresented. So because the study was funded by NIMHD, National Institute of Health, Minority Health Disparities, part of the argument was that studying Muslims will help us understand other groups right. who are not white or just in general not privileged.
Right, right. Now, again, the survey, and I'm hoping that all those who are Muslims, that they take the survey that I have put the link in the show notes. But to everybody, like, I would love for them to be able to follow you to, you know, give you some of the perspective that you need, maybe give you the connections that you need. So please tell us where people can find you on social media and how they follow you.
Yes. Also, you don't have to have any mental illness experience to take the survey. We need sure. to have people who have also good mental health too. You can follow me on Muslim Suicide Researcher. So that's at muslim.suicide.researcher on Instagram and TikTok. I believe my stuff gets forwarded to Facebook. I'm not very active on Facebook anymore. You know, because suicide is so, so much afflicting young people, I do try to target more like on TikTok, for example. I do try to target the audience more. And I am very passionate about youth suicide prevention, young adult suicide prevention, because it goes from between age 10 to 35 is generally the age range we look for. But suicide actually happens as young as 5 years old, which is really sad. And it has shown up as a leading cause of death, even at 5 to 9 years age group in some Asian American demographics. Oh, so wow. according to CDC data from the past 5 years. So it is very critical to get wide age representation, also right. good mental health representation, even if you don't have any experience with suicide or depression or whatever, just take it because we need reference groups, right? We right. need to compare something to somebody.
Right, right.
And we need to have a reference group. So the more people, the more diversity there is. We need more Black respondents. We need more Latinx respondents. We need more converts. We need more first generation immigrants. We need more Indigenous Muslims. We need people who are socioeconomically disadvantaged. We need people who may have experienced houselessness. We need people who may have experienced intimate partner violence. Narcissistic abuse, people who've gone to Islamic school, people who haven't gone to Islamic school, people who've gone to public school in the United States from K to 12, people who pray 5 times a day, people who don't pray. These are the differences that right. I'm going to be testing for.
Right.
So these are the type of people that we really need to get. And especially people in the Muslim community who are invisibilized, queer Muslims, trans Muslims. Yo, I'm out here.
Right.
I'm trans. I'm non-binary. I'm gender fluid. So, you know, I feel like it's important to get that representation, people who are multiracial, people who are biracial. So, you know, people who've never had a suicide attempt. So inshallah, I hope that that covers the wide range of what this survey is trying to get at.
I hope so. And I hope that, you know, people who are listening will seriously like take the survey. We need the information. We need to create pathways of help, and I'm so glad that you're helping to do that, Amelia. I'm so grateful for that. So to everybody, please, who are Muslims, take the survey. You know, she needs the demographic, she needs the all the things to bring all
it's
of this
our work though it's right. not my work. One thing I always say to people, sorry to cut you off, but it's our work. Suicide prevention is a collective responsibility. So when you put your little, you know, nugget of information, saving one life is as if saving all of humanity. As Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Quran. So, you know, it feels like it's my work, but I'm just a conduit. And I do feel like I'm doing Allah's work. God's work is in my, you know, it's just what I was born to do. That's how I see it. But it's not only my responsibility. We all have a responsibility. And if the only thing you can do is share the survey, then you've done your work.
Right, right. No, thank you so much, Amelia. And thank you to everybody who's listened in and watched us on YouTube. Y'all take care of yourself, take care of your mental health, and may peace be on you all.
Assalamu alaikum.
Thank you so much for tuning in to I'm a Muslim and That's Okay. And if you wish to follow my social media for more updates, you can follow me on Instagram, on Facebook, and on YouTube. All the links to those are in the show notes. And if you are on Apple or on Spotify or on Podchaser, please do give my podcast a 5-star rating. It really does help get me, you know, in the public eye. And if you wish to donate to support the podcast, you can do so through the PayPal link in my show notes as well. Take care.